All right, this is Randy Morrison.
Well, hi, Randy. What's going on?
And you're supposed to say, and this is Jim. This is Jim Ranchler, or maybe something like that.
Well, I just like, hi, Randy, hi, Jim. But
all right, hi, Jim.
Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Well, we're looking into an interesting topic this week. We're trying to figure out one of the biggest, and of course the biggest questions in physics are usually the simplest questions. What is up with the arrow of time? Why do we experience time in one direction? That's what we're going to look at this week.
Okay, so as I understand the whole idea about this arrow of time thing, there are lots of different things people have proposed that could possibly be the reason why we have this arrow of time, that there is a future and not future past and a past future. There's just a future and a past. So how are we going to look at this today? Are we going to look at just a big overview, or are we just going to look at one facet?
Well, the previous models have primarily focused on initial conditions of the Big Bang that set us going in one direction in time. But then in 2004, Sean Carroll came up with an explanation with Jennifer Chen where they looked at a thermodynamic model where entropy is determining the direction of time. This paper that we're looking at, this is going to be called The Identification of a Gravitational Arrow of Time, by three physicists, at least one of them is from the Perimeter Institute in Ontario, Canada, and it was published in Physical Review Letters, which, as we've just been discussing, is the gold standard in physics papers.
I'd like to get into something right there. So you were talking about that Chen paper, right? Is that actually how people talk about this stuff in the places where you discuss this online? Is people weren't talking about the thermodynamic idea previous to Carroll and Chen?
Well, not that I can recall offhand. It seems like they formalized the theory and it got a lot of public attention over the last decade or so. So when people are looking at an arrow of time, this seems to be the idea that they're going back to. I'm not sure if this was the inception of the idea, but it seems like perhaps the most authoritative.
I mean, it certainly is not the origination because, you know, that paper came out in what, 2004?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm looking here at a book called The Physical Basis of the Direction of Time by a guy named Zhe. And this is the fourth edition of this book, and that came out in 1999. I picked it up because I was reading probably the third edition in graduate school, and this was the one that was available for purchase at that time. So even then, sort of the first thing that he's talking about is the thermodynamical arrow of time. Maybe, since I haven't read that archive paper from Carroll and Chen, maybe that goes into a little more detail and makes a little bit better a case. But, you know, this thermodynamic arrow of time has been very popular for a very long time. The main reason for that is the only place in physics where you have a real necessity for there to be an arrow of time at all is in thermodynamics.
Right.
Or at least that's the normal way you're looking at things. So the big problem with the arrow of time is the fact that there is an arrow of time. You know, physical laws, for the most part, physical laws are time symmetric. The one I like most is to describe, you know, the waves rippling out from throwing a pebble in a pond. Turns out there are two sets of equations in the basic physics for waves that are perfectly fine. Two equations, both of which describe the situation perfectly well. And according to normal physics, you should be able to see one, the other, or both in any combination as long as the energy is conserved, right? And, you know, one of those things is called the retarded solution. And the retarded solution is the one where the rock goes in the water, and then you see the little ripples coming out. And then there's the advanced solution. You see the ripples coming in, and the rock happens to hit right in the center of where the ripples converge.
And it kicks the rock right out, and so all of that works physically.
I think it's not that it kicks the rock out, but maybe that's correct. Maybe it does have to kick the rock out. The important thing is that the equivalent impulse should be able to do either of the two things, because they're both perfectly good solutions for that impulse, for that quick push right at that spot. Either of those things can happen. And it just so happens that the only one we can see is the waves coming out. Now, I think that if it had been the way you think, that these things could all come together and pop the rock out, I think that would be a completely different situation because you'd still have the arrow of time. You'd still have a causal event here. It's just that this perfectly random, apparently, thing happening caused something to happen. But it would all seem perfectly normal to you or me other than the fact that the rock came out. that'd be something that would be okay. The reason why you want to think of it that way as not normal is the thermodynamic problem. And thermodynamics says there has to be an arrow to time. The big problem with it is it doesn't say which way.
Hmm, okay.
So there's a thing called this H theorem by this cat by the name of Boltzmann. This H theorem by Boltzmann. I shouldn't run around calling him a cat and pretending like it's, you know, 1953. So that H theorem says that there's this quantity that's always increasing, and eventually you can figure out that that statistical quantity is the entropy.
Right.
And that sort of entropy idea is where you get, you know, you can't reverse your film and the thing looks weird. So that's one thing, but it's just a little bit different here is where the idea is that you have two solutions and you just can't use one, even though according to the physics, it's perfectly okay.
One of the things that this paper gets into that really is fascinating is the way that it models the problem. They're looking at an entirely new way of explaining physical processes that I thought was really riveting. That I rarely, if ever, see. I mean, there was a time, you know, you see this with major breakthroughs, like when Einstein discovered the general theory of relativity, where you look at the nature of forces and action in a totally different way than we'd thought of it before. Before Einstein, we thought of gravity as a force. And then with his model, suddenly the force was actually just a geometrical problem of space-time, and things were still moving. They were just following a path of geodesic of least energy, right? So that's what I find amazing about this paper, is that they take a look at an entirely different order of law, physical law, and then they talk about how what we observe comes out of that. So they're looking at quantities like complexity as a driving force, and structure as these driving forces, almost like they're exerting a force on nature, but these quantities are dimensionless. And so they're not actually forces. So the universe goes from this state of being highly structurally symmetric to becoming incredibly structurally asymmetric as it expands and galaxies form. And these are the driving concepts behind the evolution of the universe. I thought that was really riveting. So we're going to talk about that tonight.
Yeah, that's going to be fairly interesting seeing how they figure that out or how that actually works, because it's a little strange. So why are we looking at, well, why were they looking at gravitational systems in particular? That's, I think, a fairly interesting question, rather than the thermodynamic system.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Let me know what you think is interesting about it.
Well, I think the interesting thing was the assertion that self-gravitating systems, like, say, the universe, have the possibility of exhibiting anti-thermodynamic behavior.
Ah, yeah. Because you've got increasing structure, is that it? That it's sort of anti-entropy?
Yeah, so it would be doing the opposite thing that you'd normally think of thermodynamically just because of the way all the constituents are interacting through the gravitational forces.
So it's kind of like the self-gravitating system is an exception to what we're normally used to thinking about of the universe's thermodynamic system, in that it can now be expressed in terms of recording information from one period to the next, and that information is increasing through time.
Yeah, something very much like that. So now I've got to think about that. I mean, later on in the paper, he talks about information. And when I first went through that, fortunately, since this was in the Physical Review Letters, rather than being a 60-page review paper or something, I had enough time to read it twice.
Good.
I mean, when I first went through it, I was thinking that maybe when he was talking about this monotonic growth of information, that he was talking about Shannon information, right? Which is the kind of information that you get in information theory and the kind of information that is very similar to entropy. But I think he means something different than this. And the reason why I think he means something different from this is that how he's defining information in this paper is, you know, if you have some situation, the amount of information you can know at a time t, having observed the universe from a time zero to a time t, is how well you can predict what that system is going to look like at infinite time in its end state. And I don't think that that's exactly what the Shannon information is, or what the thermodynamic information is. So the thermodynamic information is saying something like, if I have a physical state, a thermodynamic state, how many different ways can there be a microstate of, you know, all your little atoms doing all their little things? How many different ways can you have all of the atoms in my cup of water at, you know, 20 degrees centigrade? How many different ways can they arrange themselves? That's the information. So there are more ways they can arrange themselves at, you know, 20 degrees C than at minus 3 degrees C. So there's more entropy in there or something like that. And this is completely different, or as far as I know, this is a different concept. So I think that's also interesting, the way they're characterizing the information, which is in what I think most people would think is a more natural definition of information.
Well, I know that they start building this concept, this theory, with the Newtonian n-body problem, which is kind of an interesting thing unto itself. But you get enough different bodies interacting together, and the future solutions become increasingly difficult to predict, right? Because little changes can mean all these deviations in the future that get so out of control that you can't even predict them later.
Well, I wonder a little bit about that because of the way they were talking about it. So I guess we have to be fairly specific. They have a specific n-body problem in mind.
Right, because it's got zero energy, zero momentum, zero angular momentum, right?
Yeah, and that's important because of two reasons. One, that nothing outside of the universe affects the universe. So if you don't have zero total energy, zero momentum, and zero angular momentum, that means stuff that's outside of the universe, whatever that means.
Yeah, it defines an external reference frame. Right?
That's right. So that means there's something outside that not only is an external reference frame, it's something outside that can affect what's happening on the inside. You know, it means only internal degrees of freedom affect the universe. And that's very interesting to me, just that's that much of an important consideration. And the other thing that this allows is that there should be a scale invariance. That means it doesn't matter what size you look at, all of the physics is going to stay the same.
Well, one of the things that touches on that I'd like to do a program on sometime is the idea of the universe that weighs nothing, that Lawrence Krauss talks about. Because there is a really strong theoretical argument, even confirmed by cosmic microwave background radiation measurements, that the net mass of the universe is zero. So that would tie in nicely with this postulate that there's a zero total energy in the universe.
I think that's what it would have to mean is, I guess in this situation where you've got, or we've just got massive bodies and their interaction with each other. So that would mean that all of the kinetic energy in the universe minus all of the potential energy of the universe is zero, or the gravitational potential energy. And that's one of the things that they're talking about in this paper. And that makes life fairly interesting. So it would be fun to talk about that at some point. But the strange thing about this n-body problem, and I guess this has been known for a long time, I mean, the reference to it is one of the things in the Landau-Lipschitz series on theoretical physics, is that the clusters are going to expand at a much lower rate than the clusters are going to separate. So if you get little globs of matter in the universe, like, say, I don't know, a solar system or, say, a galaxy or something like that, mm-hmm. Those things apparently are going to keep expanding.
Away from each other, is that the idea?
Away from each other at some rate, unless they kind of get trapped, which also happens. But those clusters expand at a slower rate than they separate from each other, which means sort of the nearest parts of those clusters are getting farther and farther apart faster than they're expanding. So even though the universe is expanding, they're getting relatively farther apart.
That raises one of the questions that came up in my mind while I was reading this paper that either I didn't understand or they didn't address too specifically is, so are they saying that it's just a form of this law that makes the universe expand and congeal into galaxies? It almost seems like they're saying that that's done without a force. That's just an organizational principle at the bedrock of the universe.
Well, the way they're doing this is basically that way, but I think that does come about through the force, or it comes about through the energy, from the potential energy.
Oh, I see. Right.
So first they go through with the gravitational potential energy, and that's how they get the moment of inertia for the universe. And that's the thing that they're going to do all the scaling with. But first, they have to get that moment of inertia. And that moment of inertia, again, is the kinetic energy of everything in the universe minus the potential energy of everything interacting with everything else in the universe. And that's purely Newtonian.
Okay. Looking at the description that they're talking about here, it looked to me like the center of mass moment of inertia was only defined at a point in that initial state. And then it seems like it spreads out somehow. Is that what we're seeing? It's almost like it was only defined as a point in the beginning, but then the center of mass moment of inertia spreads out up that U shape on both sides of that point. I mean, is there a center of mass moment of inertia for the universe? Is that what they're saying? Or was that, did that only exist in the beginning?
Well, this is for everything. So I'm not sure what they mean, how that center of mass for the moment of inertia works for every reference frame.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I guess since this is a purely Newtonian toy model that they're talking about in this case, you know, they say they have a expansion into general relativity, but this letter is only dealing with the Newtonian universe. That means the center of the universe in this model never changes.
Okay.
So the center of mass of the universe never changes its position. And the moment of inertia changes as it expands and contracts. And that minimum moment of inertia is going to be the spot where they have, when we get back into this complexity thing, is the least complex point in history. I mean, as they say here, the moment of inertia is U-shaped. What they mean by that is that it has a spot in this cluster where it's smallest, and then as it expands, this complexity is going to be increasing linearly, but the moment of inertia will become increasing quadratically. But it doesn't matter which side of that expansion or contraction you're on, it's still going to be quadratic.
Yeah, let's describe that, the general contours of this model first before we get into some more of the details. They're looking at this, they show you three different frames of the universe. You've got the frame in the center is where there's a minimum complexity and matter is pretty much uniformly distributed, and there's very low information, I guess, in there. And then on the left side and the right side, you've got states where the universe has expanded significantly overall, and the matter has clustered, much like we see galaxies and so forth. And I guess one we might think of is backwards in time, and the other ones we might think of as forwards in time. But observers in both of those universes would perceive an origin point at the same point.
Yeah, this was already prior to reading this, my favorite idea about time, which is that, you know, matter at some point congeals into a small ball, as small as it can get, and then it comes back out. But it doesn't matter what side you're on of that. If you're going away from...
If your complexity is increasing in either direction, right?
Yeah, your complexity in this case is increasing in either direction. But the idea is time is pointing away from the contraction. Whether somebody who was, if there was some way to look up at it from outside of time, inside of the universe, you've got the contraction in the middle and time is going out in either direction. And time is always going away from the contractions, always going with the expansion. Whether or not you're at this sort of most complex point, or if, you know, there's a point where it rebounds, if you're going away from a point where it's as complex as it's going to get, and now it starts contracting back in. So you're always going away from the tight ball and towards the loose configuration.
Well, one of the things that's to love about that idea is that it kind of eliminates the idea of a Big Bang singularity. You know, suddenly you don't need to have an origin happening where everything is created out of nothing from a singularity. You just need this state of matter, what both observers in either universe would see as the beginning.
Yeah, I actually like that idea, and it's nice that this replicates that. I shouldn't like something because it makes sense to me.
Only a physicist could say that.
But really, the way this works is sort of confirming my prejudices about how the universe should work, which is nice, because as far as a theory of time would be concerned, it's very simple. It's simple to understand this comparatively. I think I'll have to reread that book by Zag and the physical basis for the direction of time, just to see if it makes more sense, you know, 15 years after I last read it. And I think probably it should, but still it's...
Well, a couple questions came to mind looking at this really simple idea. And one of them for me was, are we looking at a cyclical universe model here, where it goes from this state of highly ordered, high density uniformity to the really complex expanded universe that we see today, and then it collapses again towards that point of high organization?
I think they're completely agnostic about how it got there.
No, I'm just saying, are we talking about a universe that goes from the condensed matter in the in what we would perceive as the beginning to the really highly complex structures that we see now, and then back to a really highly ordered?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I think they're agnostic about it. I mean, that's what I was sort of talking about earlier. And that's sort of the idea that I like best. But this is completely agnostic about that. I think it requires some sort of positive cosmological constant to actually work with general relativity. But beyond that, I don't think they say anything about that. Having a positive cosmological constant might preclude...
A collapse. Okay, because I can understand that if it really is a U-shape and not like a sine wave, then it makes sense to me. And I guess we'd have to believe that there is a different universe that's moving in the opposite direction of time, but is sort of following the same general contours in physical law and ordering itself and so forth. So what you're saying too, is that there must be a different universe on the other end of time?
Looking at this, it works in that way, which is the way that they've shown it. That's what they've shown. But the mathematics for this would work even with a Big Bang.
Okay.
So even with there being a single origin point and things happening from there, it would still work. But if this works, there would be no reason why there wouldn't be something going the other direction.
Okay.
Does that make sense? There's no reason why it wouldn't do that. I mean, otherwise you just have some random ball of stuff that happened to be there, and now we have time. But it's only going in the one direction. It probably, if you have a random ball of stuff, there should be something going on either side.
Right. Yeah, that's what I got out of it. They've got the images of two, they're not the same universe on both sides of that origin point. You know, those look different. So that's interesting that they don't have to be so perfectly symmetrical that there's an identical, like, mirror universe moving in the opposite direction. But that opposite universe does follow the exact same laws and conserve the same quantities, but could have an entirely different reality. The thing that troubles me is that if there is a cyclical quality to it, if it goes from this ordered state to the highly complex state and then back to the highly ordered state again, then I have to wonder which direction at the middle point is forward in time.
At the very middle point, there wouldn't be a forward in time.
So time would be moving backwards as it got more orderly?
At that very middle point. Okay, so I guess what do we mean by middle point?
Maximum complexity.
As in the maximum complexity. Yeah, that's interesting. I've always wanted to write a science fiction story based on that idea.
That there's a point where time reverses direction?
Yeah, because what would in my mind be that way, and you know, you'd have to do it in some fake way so that it would be anthropomorphized and enough that you can talk about it, but the actual state that's going to be that complex will be probably long after there's human life around to notice. But the way it would work is that you'd have to have two stories.
Yes, they have two different...
That converge at the exact same spot.
That's exactly right.
That somehow it has to make sense that it's the last.
Yes, you'd have two at that moment, you'd have two pasts converging.
But there's no future. So that would be a really interesting thing to figure out how to make it work.
Yeah.
And how to make it clear that that was what was going on.
Yes.
But that's the way it would have to work in something like this. If you're going to end up with that cyclical universe, is that eventually there's a spot where everything sort of reverses, but it's not really reversing because it's converging in both spots. And then there's just that one spot that they've both converged to. It's one of these weird things that doesn't really make much sense until you start thinking about it in that science fiction-y story way.
Mm.
Even if you can't figure out what the story is, just figuring out the story's outlines is one of those things that makes it actually make a little bit of sense. which might be bad.
It does sound like a fun story, though. The weird thing is, you wouldn't have any physically defining event, really. Let's see if we can talk a little bit about the fascinating approach to physics that they get into here. Because I love that it's so unfamiliar. They're not talking about ordinary Newtonian physical laws creating structure and all of that. They're talking about a higher order of reality that precipitates what we see as Newtonian reality.
Yeah, they're doing some weird things with the shape of the universe. And they're just trying to look at how the shapes are changing. And so they're looking at sort of internal ideas about the shape that, you know, really do come from the gravitational problem. But, you know, they've abstracted out about as much as they can. And then they turn this into a Hamiltonian. Now, this is perfectly fine in Hamiltonian mechanics. What they do is they construct a system, and then they look at invariant quantities, and they find this momentum that's associated with the shape.
Yeah, I'd never heard of shape momenta before, or dilational momentum.
I don't think you're going to find a lot of places for that, but this is what they're looking for is, you know, if I'm expanding, if my universe is expanding, then I have one degree of freedom, which is sort of the size of the universe. This is not so much different than in cosmology where you have the Hubble constant, right? And then you say, okay, on top of that, if I have this size of the universe that's changing, I have to have a secondary quantity, which is how much it's changing, how fast it's changing. And so you have one quantity that's sort of like the position for this entire shape. And then you have another quantity that's sort of like the momentum, but now for the entire shape, for the entire expansion. So you have shape and expansion, and that's what you have to work with rather than position and momentum.
And in this alternative view of physics, they describe the complexity itself as a kind of attractor, which is pulling the universe into a larger size and a more complex shape.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing that they're looking at. And this complexity is a ratio of two lengths.
Right. The root mean square length, right?
Yeah, it's a root mean square length, where basically what they've done is they've weighted the distances between every single massive object in the universe by their masses. So it's the mass of E1 times mass of 2 times the square of the distance between them. And you sum all those up, which is sounding a little bit like the moment of inertia already. Then you take the square root of that, and then you divide by the total mass of the universe, which would be the first moment. So you're sort of taking the second moment of the mass and dividing by the first mass. But, you know, it's just your average length scale between things. So you have different ways you can average it. This is sort of the normal way that you'd average something like this. It's the first one that doesn't end up at zero other than the total mass. And so in that way, you get your root mean squared distance. And that's sort of dominated by the things that are farthest apart from each other. And then you divide by this mean harmonic length, which is more or less the square of the total mass divided by the total potential energy of the entire system. It sort of tells you something about the potential energy, whereas the other one tells you about the spread. And that potential energy one is dominated by the close things, right? So you have more potential energy at the close spots, whereas the other one's dominated by the large spots. And so you have a ratio between this quantity that's related to how far the farthest things are from each other. And then you have the other one that's dominated by the idea of how close are the closest things to each other. And that's your complexity.
And the complexity appears that time is going forward as the complexity increases, right?
Yeah, well, in fact, according to this, that's what's making the time go forward, right? Is that plus one other thing. As this complexity increases, that's what is making time go forward. That is time's forwardiness, the increase in complexity of the universe in this sort of scaling situation.
Yeah, there is an equation here that talks about how the potential attracts the system towards more inhomogeneous shapes. It just absolutely fascinates me that you can find a Hamiltonian and mathematically model the universe this way, in such a way that seems so unphysical to us, so unintuitive, you know?
Yeah, you normally don't think of things, you're absolutely right, in this sort of way. This is a very topological way to look at the universe.
Yeah, but that's what makes it so fascinating and why I love this paper so much. You know, you can apply the same physical principles and mathematical quantities and mathematical language to this, and it makes sense, but it makes sense in the weirdest way. And one of the other things that grabbed my attention was when he said that in this model, scale acts as friction on the shapes.
So when they scaled that momentum down by the sort of size of the universe or something like that, what was the d standing?
That was the dilational momentum, I think.
Okay, so when they take the ratio between the shape momentum, basically, and the dilational momentum, how much it's got for this moving outness, that strangely adds a sort of viscous term to the canonical momentum of the system.
Which is dimensionless. So you've got it even bends my mind. How can you have a momentum which is dimensionless?
Well, remember, this is a dimensionless momentum. So what they've done is they've taken a momentum and divided by a momentum.
Right.
And this can still be, this is still a valid quantity for the system.
Fascinating. Okay.
And the interesting thing is that it shows up. The interesting thing is that it shows up as a viscous term in that canonical, in that equation for the canonical momentum with this scaling parameter, lambda. That's a scaling parameter used instead of time. Because they're trying to explain time, they can't use time as the thing that's moving forward and backwards in time. Mm-hmm. What they're looking at instead is the scaling. To say, okay, as this gets larger and larger, what happens as it gets larger and larger? And they say, oh, look, time shows up because it's getting larger and larger. So they've had to rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of lambda instead of T to get there.
Okay, so it's dissipating this dimensionless momenta quantity as we experience time moving forward. The complexity of the shapes grows because it's basically the negative potential energy of the system with friction.
So that original momentum was something that's related to the potential energy. And then we get something extra when we divide by the dilational momentum that is proportional to the momentum itself, which is going to slow down the system.
Another fascinating part of this model that really grabbed my imagination was that they're describing the complexity growing in the universe is basically recording the information of what we perceive as the past in the same way. It's almost like the universe has a memory, just as we have a memory.
That's really where they lose me, because, you know, I spent a little bit of time on this trying to figure out what it meant. Were we recording when I talked about the Shannon entropy?
I believe you said yes, you were.
Okay. You know, I was thinking it meant one thing when I read it the first time, then I was pretty sure it meant something slightly different. But still, the way they got there, I wasn't completely sure how it worked.
I think in general terms, I feel like they're saying that just like the universe is growing in complexity from our point of view, so is our own neural patterns are growing in complexity. That for both the universe and for our brains, we perceive the past to be the point in which the complexity was less, when there was lower memory, right?
They actually made that analogy?
No, but they did liken, they did say that just like our own memory is doing this, so is the universal complexity doing this.
Okay, well, I mean, I can understand that this complexity, the way it works, in some way is going to do that, because obviously, you know, once you start getting more clustering, you have fewer possibilities for the future. So you have more information about what the final state is going to be. So that's sort of the way I'm taking it right now, what I'm seeing here. But I'm not completely sure. I mean, it's interesting, you know, you still have the sort of things that you'd see in information theory in this case, like...
That's right.
Like this number that's telling you how much information you have is, you know, the logarithm of the ratio of what's going to happen at the end of the universe divided by everything you know up to that point in time. And so that's a little bit like the normal sort of information idea that you'd have. Obviously, you have a slight problem with calculating that number because it requires you to know what's going to happen based on what really happens in the end state, and then dividing it by how much you know, which is obviously problematical practically.
But I do love the idea that the universe is like this information-generating machine, and that we experience time as moving from one state of lower information to a higher information. Because that's like the opposite of the entropy argument, right?
I'd have to think about that. That is sort of the opposite of that. But I've never had a really great grasp of the connection between information theory and statistical thermodynamics. And so there's always that sort of issue. I generally think that more entropy means less information, because more entropy means you have more possible ways to make the state that you know. We're decreasing the amount of information in the universe as we increase our entropy, because there are more ways to make the universe as it is.
So that's what you meant by there must be a different definition of information in the two different models.
Well, I think we've already talked about the different definition of the two different models. So in the Shannon information idea, or in the statistical thermodynamics idea, what your information is, or what your entropy is basically how many different ways can the same state be realized. So you have a macro state, which is something you can measure, and then you have a micro state, which is something you can't measure. Like I was talking about, all of the atoms in your water glass, or all of the molecules in the air and all that other stuff. And so your entropy increases when you have more dissimilar ways of making the same macro state. So you have less information about the micro state. Whereas in this case, as time goes on, you have more and more information about the final state. So it's a little bit different because you're measuring now and then trying to predict the end state of the universe. So this is what is it, teleological in nature? Is that the right word?
I don't know.
There's actually an even scarier one about the study of the end of days, but I don't remember what it is. You know, religious stuff gets all the cool words.
I'll have to look up teleological. The philosophical attempt to describe things in terms of their apparent purpose, directive principle, or goal. Oh, there you go. End state, I guess, would apply to that.
Yeah, I think I've got the wrong one, but I think teleological is often used for that purpose. I'm going to avoid trying to Google that because I'll sit around all night Googling and then I'll get lost in New Kingdom Nubian hairstyles for women or something.
Yeah, it's dangerous to look at the internet when you're trying to focus. That's all right. But from there, the paper does a really interesting thing. They talk about spontaneous geometrogenesis, which is they're talking about how our Newtonian ideas of time and scale precipitate from this model as effective concepts.
It's pretty interesting that more or less time and space both sort of come out of this, right? So the way this is looking at it is just the scaling behavior of the universe when you don't assume there's any time, just the universe has a minimum complexity portion and higher complexity portions, and how do you get from one to the other? You end up with time and space the way time and space are more or less the way we think about it. And, you know, that's nice. I would like to look at this in their more complex paper with all the general relativity stuff to see what they actually mean, because 2.5 paragraphs is not really enough to make much sense of it. Right?
Yeah, all they really do is they point at the Keplerian pairs. And how bodies orbiting one another have a major axis and they have an orbital period, and therefore we have rods and clocks and a reference frame.
Yeah, so we're stuck with the reference frame there and all that other stuff. I mean, it makes sense that in some way this works, but while reading this, and this is one of these places where I was always a little bit confused, is sometimes it seems like they're talking about the universe, and sometimes it sounds like they're just talking about the clusters. And all of the mathematics works for both of them, to be honest. You know, our little cluster for a galaxy and our little cluster for a solar system works perfectly well with all of this mathematics. So what does that mean in this case about time in general? You know, does it mean that you can end up with different eras of time in different places because of the way things are expanding or contracting locally?
I hadn't thought about that.
Of course, this is a very short paper, so maybe, you know, it's not really unexpected that in 5 pages they don't answer that question. The only issue is that I was never completely able to figure out whether it was a universal expansion or a cluster expansion and so forth and so on. So when I read through it again, all of a sudden I wasn't completely sure about what was going on. First time I read through it, I was pretty sure it was just universal, but the second I was starting to think that maybe there was more importance to the clusters than I gave them in the first reading.
Well, I think that it would have to be basically like a fractal idea, where it applies universally and in a large cluster and to a small cluster pretty much uniformly. Because otherwise, when we looked across the universe and looked back in time, we might see time moving in a different direction, and we don't see that.
But we are already talking about, let's say, the expansion of the universe versus the expansion of the clusters, right? The separation being more or less the cluster expansion to the 3/2 power. So it may be in some way that the total universe in this model should have a stronger time than the clusters, or maybe vice versa.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to take a look at that paper and see if they get into that.
I doubt they get into that. I think I started thinking too much about it. There was one thing that I got confused about on the second reading, and then I probably put it on to everything after that. So I'm not really sure how that works. You know, it could also be that, you know, they add so that you have different things going on in different spots. You have a major effect with the expansion of the universe, and then you have a minor effect with your expansion of your galaxy, let's say. And the two things are going at a different rate, and maybe two galaxies have slightly different expansion rates. And maybe they have slightly different times that you wouldn't be able to notice the differences in.
Do we know what's happening with the galaxies in terms of their long-term evolution? Do they coalescing, or do they reach like a steady state? Do you have any idea about that?
That is one of the many things I do not know.
Yeah.
You know, this is very far away from playing with magnets. Especially things like that I don't know. Was I telling you last time that I had that really nice book by Schütz on gravity?
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, so I think the earlier chapters that I skipped, I was trying to prepare for this stuff, I think it has a lot of information like that, so it might actually tell us more about that.
Well, one of the things that I'd love to see that, of course, a short paper like this couldn't get into, and they didn't even make an effort to really unify it with general relativity, but it does raise some some interesting questions about, you know, the time dilation effect, you know, both with special relativity and with general relativity. Why are there different rates of time experienced by different observers? Maybe this theory reduces to, you know, general relativity in the same way that we saw with Newtonian physics.
Well, this theory? Yeah, I think this theory reduces to general relativity, did you say?
Well, yeah, they said how a Newtonian physics kind of emerges as an effective, like our principles of Newtonian physics emerge as effective quantities out of it. So a similar thing would have to happen with general relativity if it was going to hold water, right?
I think they say they kind of have a good idea about that. You know, they have the whole expansion to general relativity, but in that, they have to do some different things, apparently, with the shape dynamics. But it apparently figures out something about time. Rather than using the moment of inertia around the center of mass of the universe, they have to use another quantity. Rather than using the dilational momentum, they have to use something called the York time, I believe. And so, you know, they can do similar things, and they have done similar things in one of these archive papers that get you a lot of the information, but it's obviously not in here more than a couple of paragraphs where they're describing the extensions.
This is a fun paper to get familiar with entirely, you know, more abstracted physical laws that they're talking about, though. It was a lot of fun to look at.
I enjoyed it very much. Now, I don't remember why I did this other than at some point you said you wanted to do something with the arrow of time, and, you know, we're trying to alternate between small and large here most of the time, and it just showed up in one of my searches. Actually, for some reason, before I printed it out, I thought it was an old 1950s paper, but it turned out to be a lot more contemporary, which was very nice.
Well, and I'd like to give a little shout out to the Perimeter Institute, because I've keep coming across these amazing theoretical papers that they're involved with. Seems like their name keeps coming up. I really love the work they're doing.
Oh yeah, and if they need anybody to draw them stuff, go to you.
That's right. Well, thanks for your time and bringing this paper up. But Jim, it was a really interesting foray into a really fascinating theoretical subject, the nature of our direction of time.
Nice talking to you, Randy. Talk to you again next week.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, bye now.